Today's message is entitled, I've Heard It From a Friend of a Friend. There's a story about a woman by the name of Sarah, no one around here obviously, who was known as the church gossip and self-appointed arbiter of congregational morals. And she kept sticking her nose into everybody's business. Several members were quite unappreciative of her activities, but they feared her enough to maintain their silence. She made a mistake, however, when she accused George, who was a new member to the church, of being an alcoholic after she saw his pickup truck parked in front of the town's only bar one afternoon. She commented to George and others that everyone seeing it there would know what he was doing. George, a man of very few words, stared at her for a long moment and just walked away. He didn't explain himself, he didn't deny, he didn't defend, he said nothing. Later that evening, George quietly parked his pickup truck in front of Sarah's house and left it there all night. I say, way to go, George. How many lives have been ruined or irreparably harmed by unfounded rumors that are just floating around out there? I heard someone say, or my friend's second cousin once removed said, your reputation precedes you, we might hear. Rumors, innuendo, all of it plays out every day in every community and out of every mouth, including mine. In legal terms, we call it hearsay, and it is inadmissible in a court of law, but it seems admissible everywhere else. All of us have been hurt by hearsay over the years, and let's be honest, all of us have hurt others with hearsay. We just love to pass along juicy little tidbits, whether they're legitimate or not. Recently, I received an email from one of my pastor colleagues who's here locally, who had heard from somebody that I had died. I thought immediately of Samuel Clemens, or who is better known as Mark Twain, who was responding to a news report of his death in the 1897 New York Journal, and he replied, reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. For a long time, I've wondered, why do we do it? What drives us to share hearsay to all the itchy ears that we encounter? We love it so much that we have an entire genre of media that's dedicated to rumors. Entertainment Tonight, The National Enquirer, People Magazine, and the ridiculous occupation called paparazzi. All of it fueled with our fascination for juicy tidbits that in all reality have very little, if at all, anything to do with us. Why do we do that? Recently, I completed a very interesting exploration of why Homo sapiens, that is you and I, emerged as the predominant and only surviving human species on the planet. At one time, it surprises people when I say this, there were other humanoid types of species around. The one that we most know about are the Neanderthals. Yuval Noah Harari, in his book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, suggests that our spreading of rumors is what gave we sapiens an edge over other humanoids. Unlike other living things, humans communicate to each other with great flexibility and detail, and this gave us a great edge over all other species. We are also very social beings, again adding to our success, and to maintain our connections to each other, we needed to not only pass along information like where to find food and what dangers are out there, but also about social developments in relationships to maintain the bonds of our communities. Things like who's sleeping with who and who hates who, these are all critical to maintaining social order and connection. If this is so, it explains why we still gossip so easily it is a part of our makeup. It's passed down for countless eons. The problem arises when this ingrained ability to gossip is manipulated to further an agenda that can be harmful or selfishly motivated by the dispenser of such gossip. I cannot help but think of a current sitting U.S. president and how he uses falsehood and half-truths to try and maintain power. Today, I want us to consider how rumor played a role in the story of Nehemiah and his leadership of the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem after the exile. We will focus on what is perhaps the most vital question in all that we talk about when it has to come to rumors. What is your motivation? For every action we undertake, there is always a motivation. Motivation is the keystone of every project that we undertake. One of the things I've learned from reading a mystery novel or watching a crime drama on TV is that the key to figuring out who did what crime is an understanding of the motive. Why did that person murder that other person? Why did they steal that particular thing? I've also figured out that a great deal of morality of any action usually comes down to our motive. Did I do such and such a thing for selfish reasons like greed or power? Or were my motives selfless in caring for another? Furthermore, if we haven't got a handle on our motivation, then our thinking, our planning, and even our relationships can get all muddled up. Just think of the first question that comes out of our mouths when someone does something that hurts us or disappoints us. Like perhaps one of our children. The first question is always, why? It may also be, what were you thinking? But essentially those two questions are the same thing. The question why goes right to a person's motive. As Nehemiah chapter 6 opens, we discover that the wall is nearly complete, although the gates have not yet been hung on the wall. It's been about 6 months since King Artaxerxes permitted Nehemiah to return to Jerusalem to some of the exiles. In just 52 days, they had rebuilt the wall. And we know almost with a certainty that that occurred on October the 2nd. The enemies of Nehemiah, such as Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab, have failed to stop the construction or even to slow it down. The wall is now out of their influence. So these enemies try a different approach. Chapter 6 becomes a report of a series of manipulative attempts by rumor to discredit or harm Nehemiah. The thinking was, at least for Sanballat and friends, that if they got rid of Nehemiah, they could still control the city of Jerusalem, even if it had a wall. Like the old idiom, you cut off the head of the snake and the snake dies. Kill the leader, and the population is vulnerable. The first attempt to harm Nehemiah that they made is a relatively simple one. Sanballat and Geshem sent a message desiring a meeting with Nehemiah. The meeting was to take place in an outlying village, perhaps near the border of Samaria. Unfortunately, the actual location of this village has been lost to history. However, the motivation of Sanballat and Geshem is very clear. Nehemiah sees this invitation for what it is. It's a plot to harm him. However, rather than inflame the situation further, Nehemiah simply responds back that he's just too busy in completing this great project, namely the wall. It is simply a diplomatic excuse that Nehemiah is giving them. As time-wise, a trip to Ono would not really have harmed the progress of the wall at all. Nehemiah knows, however, that no good thing would come from this meeting. I don't know why, but this excuse of Nehemiah reminds me of a young lady who refuses to go on a date by saying she has to wash her hair. It's kind of like saying, I really don't want to go out with you. Having failed in their first attempt and four other times to secure a meeting, Sandblatt ups the ante. He resorts to blackmail. Sandblatt reports to Nehemiah that Geshem has heard disturbing rumors, albeit unfounded, that Nehemiah is seeking to be named king. The rumor indicates that Nehemiah's ambition is the motivation behind the building of the wall. Notice, please, again, the focus on motivation. The false rumors also indicate that Nehemiah has appointed prophets to prophesy that Nehemiah is the king. And this harkens back, of course, to the Old Testament practice of prophets anointing and declaring who was to be king. Such was the case when Samuel came and anointed Saul, and then he anointed David. The blackmail arises when Sanballat states that he will send a letter to Artaxerxes retelling these rumors. Nehemiah has no ambition to be king, and he sees right through the blackmail. The motivation is clear in that they are trying to intimidate Nehemiah. They're trying to control him. The third attempt to discredit Nehemiah is a little further on in the story, is much more elaborate, but it's much more sinister too. Nehemiah goes to visit a man by the name of Shemaiah, who's been confined to his house. Now, why he's confined to his house, it's quite unclear to us. It could be due to age, illness, or it's possible he was under house arrest. From what little we know about Shemaiah, it seems that he was a quite influential person in the city of Jerusalem, and perhaps he was even seen as a prophet by the people. It may be that Nehemiah was sent a report from Shemaiah that he had a word of the Lord to pass along to him. This would explain Nehemiah's willingness to go and see him, as any word from the Lord would be important to Nehemiah. Shemaiah reports that Nehemiah should come and join him in the temple where they could bolt the door shut to protect themselves against their enemies. Now, there were two problems with that suggestion in Nehemiah's mind. The first is his personal revulsion at running away from his enemies. As governor, it would be demeaning to a man of his stature to run with his tail between his legs and go and barricade himself in the temple. Essentially, this would also mean the temple compound would become a fortress. But this suggestion of meeting in the temple is actually a two-pronged attack. Notice that Shemaiah suggests the temple to hide in, not a house, not an armory, not a military barrack. Besides the possible security benefits of the temple, why did Shemaiah suggest going there? I'll give you a clue. Nehemiah was not a priest. The most secure part of the temple complex was the inner sanctum, or what is referred to as the Holies of Holies. It is the place in the temple where God was believed to actually dwell. Perhaps you remember the story of Zechariah from the Gospel of Luke, who was struck speechless at having encountered an angel in the Holies of Holies. They actually would tie a rope to the ankle of the priest that was going in to do incense offerings, etc., in case they somehow offended God and were struck dead inside the Holies of Holies. Needless to say, the Holies of Holies was the most sacred place in all of Judaism. In the law of Moses, only priests were allowed to enter that particular space. If Nehemiah, therefore, who is not a priest, had entered the inner sanctum, he would have caused a great scandal among the people. He would have driven a wedge between himself and the priests. Nehemiah says, "I realized that God had not spoken to him, but he had uttered this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. They were hoping to intimidate me and make me sin by following this suggestion. Then they would accuse me and discredit me." Sanballat and company knew that if the priest turned against Nehemiah, surely the rest of the population would follow. In Nehemiah chapter 13, the situation becomes even more serious in regards to the temple, but Nehemiah defends the priest and their rights to serve the people. And this clearly demonstrates that he had powerful support from the priest in that particular situation. I should also point out that a violation of the holiest of holies was, according to Mosaic law, punishable by death. Therefore, Nehemiah would not only be discredited, but also possibly stoned to death. This call to enter the temple was a clue that Shemaiah was not a true prophet of God. No prophet would call on anyone to sin or to violate the temple. Nehemiah realized that Shemaiah's motivation was that Sanballat and Tobiah had paid him to give this false testimony or this false prophecy. There's that word again, eh? Motivation. At the end of the chapter and throughout the rest of the book of Nehemiah, Tobiah takes on a greater significance as it becomes clear that through the marriage of his children, Tobiah has made alliances with several significant nobles in Jerusalem, even the chief priest. These nobles in turn reported back to Tobiah all that was going on inside the city of Jerusalem. At this time, the nobles spoke to Nehemiah about what a wonderful man Tobiah was. He wasn't that wonderful, because Tobiah himself sent threatening letters to Nehemiah to try and intimidate him. The friends of Tobiah, who were numerous, were motivated by their own self-interest. A rift between Nehemiah and Tobiah was threatening some of the nobles' carefully arranged commercial and social interests. Sanballat, through Tobiah, was putting considerable pressure on the nobility of the city to get rid of Nehemiah. It needs to be stressed that the dangers Nehemiah faced are the same ones we can all face when we seek to serve God. Such was the case for Jesus himself in Mark chapter 14, when he was brought before the high priest and the whole of the leading priests and other leaders. Verse 55 and 56 is very telling. Inside, the leading priests and entire council were trying to find witnesses who would testify against Jesus so they could put him to death. Many false witnesses spoke against him, but they contradicted each other. The experience of Nehemiah and Jesus and many other servants of God who are involved in a great project for God reveals that others will try and sidetrack us. It is critical, therefore, that our motives be clear and pure. It doesn't matter that we finish the grand project if we did so for selfish reasons. In serving God, we discover that other people may use all manner of manipulation to discredit us, to discourage us, and generally defeat us. I'm afraid to report that, just like Nehemiah, I've seen in churches rumors, false reports, and yes, even blackmail. The blackmail is often the easiest to spot because it goes something like this: if you don't do it my way, I will leave and take my money with me. Unfortunately, like Nehemiah, when confronted with blackmail and rumors, many people often give up and they quit a project. Rumors, therefore, wreck our confidence. What do we do then in the face of rumors and hearsay? Frank Tillipaul writes that life is a mission rather than an accident, a mission with eternal significance. What we forget to or fail to understand is that God didn't just throw us down here and sit back and wait to see what happens. We're not some cosmic experiment. There is a plan and there is a purpose. Can we therefore have faith enough to live like there is a plan and that there is a purpose for us? The point is well made by Roger Thompson, a leadership magazine. A sense of duty isn't enough for a long-haul motivation. A sense of purpose is. Maybe that is the most important lesson from the Nehemiah story, that purpose means power. I mean, power to fuel our motivation to complete the task at hand. Knowing our purpose is key to running the race set before us, as the Apostle Paul states. That goes for everything from building a wall to feeding the hungry to reaching out to our neighbors or whatever purpose God has given us. The other thing I should point out to you is that when we focus on our purpose, we garner confidence. Facing opposition from within and outside the city, false rumors and plots against him, and all kinds of logistical problems, Nehemiah kept going. He was confident because he knew that if he stuck to God's purpose for him, God would defend him against his enemies. Wouldn't it be great to have that kind of confidence? Especially when the Sanballats and Tobias of this world come calling. Can we join the Apostle Paul in stating categorically, we know that God causes everything to work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose for them? Wouldn't it be marvelous for people to remark of the First Baptist family as being one that is marked with great confidence and sure of its purpose? God did not go to all this effort to place us here at this moment among these people at this place to simply start some grand project. God called us to finish. Or as the writer to the Hebrews put it, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Sometimes the road will be rough and sometimes we'll stumble and get banged up a bit. Sometimes we will face opposition from the world and maybe even from those close to us. Yet if we keep our eyes on God and not on the rubble, we will persevere and we will finish well.